Chapter 5, The Skillful Will, Psychological Laws. Modern psychology has shown that if the will puts itself in direct opposition to the other psychological forces, such as imagination, emotions, or drives, it will often be overpowered. Yet the limited Victorian conception of will as a force alone prompts us to use our will in just such a direct and often clumsy or even brutal way. Or, as a reaction, we may swing to the opposite dream of not using the will at all. In other words, as we have said, there are two general mistakes caused by extreme attitudes held towards the will and its relation to the other psychological functions. One is the traditional attempt to force these functions into operation by sheer power and direct imposition. The other mistake, which is prevalent today, is to abdicate the will. Urges, drives, and desires are allowed to happen without any regulation or consistent direction. In such a situation, the function that is strongest at the moment will capture one's attention and express itself, and in so doing will inhibit or repress all the other less powerful functions. This produces inner conflict and stress, reduced effectiveness through dispersal of energies, and potentially harmful reactions within oneself and between oneself and others. We can avoid both these mistakes when we realize and remember that the will is capable of achieving its purpose, provided that it is not only strong, but also skillful. The essential function of the skillful will, which we need to cultivate, is the ability to develop that strategy which is most effective and which entails the greatest economy of effort, rather than the strategy that is most direct and obvious. For example, if we want to get a car going, and we get behind it and push with all our strength, we use a will which is only strong. But if we sit in the driver's seat, turn on the ignition, and drive the car, we use skillful will. In the first case, we have a considerable probability of failing. And even if successful, we will have needlessly expended a considerable amount of energy. We will have made a very unpleasant effort, which may leave us temporarily exhausted, and we will certainly do our best to avoid repeating such experiences in the future. In the second case, we are guaranteed success with a bare minimum of effort, provided we have previously acquired an understanding of the car and sufficient skill in handling it. The most effective and satisfactory role of the will is not as a source of direct power or force, but as that function with being at our command can stimulate, regulate, and direct all the other functions and forces of our being, so that they may lead us to our predetermined goal. But just as with the car, for this we need to have some understanding of the psychological world in which and on which the will has to operate. With this understanding, we can choose the most practical, effective, and effort-saving means and strategies to proceed along our way. We need to know the basic elements of this psychological world, the forces active in it, and the laws that regulate the will act. This knowledge leads to the skillful direction of the intended activity of the will and enables us to make countless practical applications of those psychological laws under the direction of the will. In the remainder of this chapter, we will deal with these psychological elements, forces, and laws. In the next chapter, we will present a number of specific techniques and their rationale for the use of the skillful will. These techniques, which can be seen as examples illustrating the general principles we have discussed, have been chosen because of their effectiveness in a broad range of everyday life situations. Therefore, besides representing typical utilizations of the basic concepts and methods of skillful will, they will offer the reader practical means to develop and exercise his own skillful will, and to appreciate its value out of personal experience. As one gains increased proficiency and familiarity One can then proceed to modify these techniques as desired for his individual needs and to develop new ones. Psychological elements. The general psychological structure of the human being, the relationship between the personal I and the transpersonal self, and the relationship between the area of awareness and the surrounding unconscious have been briefly indicated in Chapter 2. See diagram, page 14. There's a footnote here. It seems unnecessary to repeat here the full discussion of these points, to be found in Psychosynthesis, pages 16 through 22, returning to text. But it is also necessary to be aware of the various psychological functions and their relationship to one another. Many classifications of them have been made, but I consider the following to be the most inclusive. 1. Sensation. 2. Emotion, feeling. 3. Impulse, desire. 4. Imagination. 5. Thought. 6. Intuition. 7. Will. They are represented once again in the following diagram, in which the specific and central position of the will is indicated. So in the picture that's shown, we again have the six-sided triangle with sensation facing south, then south-west. We have emotion, feeling, impulse and desire is south-east, with imagination north-west, then thought north-east, then intuition north self with a capital S in the middle, number 8, and will below that, number 7, in a circle linking the various petals. These relationships among these functions are complex, but there are two kinds of interactions. First, those that take place spontaneously, one might say, and second, those that can be influenced, governed, and directed by the will. Psychological forces. This leads to consideration the difference between what can be called the plastic unconscious and the structured or conditioned unconscious. In classical psychoanalysis, the emphasis is on the latter, detecting repressions, complexes, conflicts, and attempting to eliminate them are the chief aims. But there is a large portion of the unconscious which is not thus conditioned. It is plastic, and its susceptibility to being influenced makes it like an inexhaustible store of unexposed photographic film. The conditioned unconscious, on the other hand, can be compared to an accumulation of already exposed film. In this respect, we are like motion picture cameras, functioning uninterruptedly, so that at every movement a new section of the sensitive film is receiving impressions of the images which happen to appear before the lens. But the new impressions thus received do not remain in a static condition. They act in us. They are living forces that stimulate and evoke other forces, in accordance with the psychological laws that will be enumerated in the next section. This may be looked at from a different angle, by employing another analogy. Just as our body is continually absorbing vital elements from the outer world, from the air, from light, water, and from various foods, and these elements exercise various influences upon it according to their nature, be they beneficial or harmful, wholesome or unwholesome, so in the same way, our unconscious is continually absorbing elements from the psychological environment. It breathes, as it were, and unceasingly assimilates psychological substances whose nature determines whether their effects upon us are beneficial or harmful. According to the Hindus, Sarvam Anam, everything is food. We feed not only on vegetarian or non-vegetarian food, but on all sound and visual vibrations, on all kinds of impressions, architectural proportions, union of forms and colours, harmonies and rhythms of music, and all the ideas with which we come in contact. All this, absorbed mechanically and without real attention throughout the day, has made up our being and continues to do so. But we can also learn to use these influences skillfully to build in ourselves what we choose to have.
For their dynamics are regulated by laws as definite as those governing physical energy. The various psychological functions can interpenetrate and interact, but the will is in a position to direct their interpenetration and interaction. The centrality of will allows its supremacy through its regulating power,
but this power is in turn governed by psychological laws. Ignoring these laws means to waste or to risk misusing the inherent power which the will, because of its centrality, has. So knowledge of these laws and the use of techniques based on them is of fundamental importance. We will enumerate here those which have a practical bearing on the use of the will. I believe that knowing these laws and some of their practical applications, which we will discuss in the next chapter, provides a firm basis for anyone who would train his will to act skillfully. The reader may want to study the laws once and then return to them later to solidify his understanding. Law 1. Images or mental pictures and ideas tend to produce the physical conditions and the external acts that correspond to them. This law has been formulated also in the following way. Every image has in itself a motor element. Every idea is an act at an initial stage. William James was one of the first to call attention to this ideomotor action, in which a central idea releases, triggers, and gives life to the waiting muscular system. The existence of this law, or process, has been abundantly proved by the effects of hypnotic influence and in the waking state of suggestion and autosuggestion. To the objection that one is often not aware that images and ideas transform themselves into actions, the reply can be made that this is because, ordinarily, numerous mental pictures crowd in on us at the same time or in rapid succession, conflicting with and hindering each other. This law is at the base of all psychosomatic influences, both pathological and therapeutic, and it is one of the facts which account for mass suggestion, so cleverly and successfully exploited by advertisers and other persuaders, including political leaders. The centrally located will can mobilize the energies of imagination and of thought and utilize these energies within the individual to carry out its plan. So the will can be used purposefully and consciously by the individual to choose, evoke, and concentrate on the images and ideas that will help to produce the actions he desires. For example, images or ideas of courage and high purpose, used skillfully, tend to evoke courage and produce courageous acts. Law 2. Attitudes, movements, and actions tend to evoke corresponding images and ideas. These, in turn, according to the next law, evoke or intensify corresponding emotions and feelings. This is clearly proved by the following experiment. If we shut the fist of a sensitive hypnotized subject, he will gradually shut the other fist, raise his arm, close his lips tightly, and frown until his entire aspect will suggest a growing inner state of anger. We know that to play a role in life tends to arouse the corresponding ideas and feelings. Thus, speaking with a harsh voice and behaving as if one were angry tends to awaken real anger. One often sees this in children who begin to fight for fun, but gradually become so involved that they end by fighting in earnest. This law provides the basis of the method used by some people to penetrate into and understand the psychological conditions of others. They artificially imitate the body posture and facial expression of someone they are observing, and in doing so, arouse in themselves the corresponding psychological conditions. Thus, the will can move the body, and by this means evoke corresponding images and ideas. which in turn will intensify the emotions and feeling it wants to strengthen. In other words, through conscious and purposeful movements, one can evoke and strengthen positive and desired inner states. The use of appropriate dance movements and the Eastern technique of mudra are typical applications of this law. A skillful use of the body under Law 2 can further strengthen the motor power, Law 1, of images and ideas. For example, the individual who is working to develop and express courage by utilizing his imagination and his thoughts, according to Law 1, can also use his body purposefully by assuming the corresponding physical attitude. Thus, his body will intensify and reinforce his imagination and thoughts, according to Law 2. And this will in turn evoke and intensify the experience of courage itself, creating a reinforcing flow of energies, a positive feedback loop, which will lead him to the sustained performance of courageous action. This law and its application will be expanded further as we discuss the technique of acting as if in the next chapter. Law 3, ideas and images tend to awaken emotions and feelings that correspond to them. This relates closely to Law 1. Ideas and images tend to produce acts in accordance with the first law, and emotions in accordance with this law. Whether acts or emotions are first awakened by a specific idea or image depends on the nature of the idea or image itself, and on the individual psychological type. Again, with a skillful application of this law, the centrally located will can mobilize the energy of the emotions and feelings through the use of appropriate ideas and images. The technique of evocative words, described at length in the next chapter, is a systemic application of this law, but examples abound from clinical practice, history, and many other spheres of life. A young man was addicted to morphine, but earnestly wanted to get rid of the slavery. He was advised to write 20 times every day a verse from a certain psalm. He did it faithfully until, after having written it about 7,000 times, he felt and remained free from the craving. 7,000 may seem a very large number, but it corresponds to less than a year's time. A famous story concerns the daughter of an English admiral who read a pamphlet by Gandhi and became so enthused with his ideas that she left for India, much to the disgust of her father. There she became Gandhi's active co-worker and for years was his secretary. One may say that the ideas of Gandhi aroused deep feelings, and these, in turn, according to Law 4 and Law 9 and Law 10, which I discuss below, led to action. Law 4. Emotions and impressions tend to awaken and intensify ideas and images that correspond to or are associated with them. The emotions evoked through ideas and images, Law 3, can in turn awaken and intensify associated ideas. Here too, we have a feedback process which can operate for good or ill. It often works negatively. For example, a fear of becoming ill breeds a series of images of illness which are harmful, both because they are depressing and still more because the mental pictures thus evoked tend to produce the corresponding physical conditions, i.e. psychosomatic troubles, through the action of Law 1. So, we are caught in a vicious circle where an emotion creates an image which in turn affects the physical condition, which produces more emotions. We can break this circle in one of several places, in accord with the laws we are considering. If we wish to begin by dealing with the emotions, the technique that is most useful is that of self-identification, described in Appendix 1, page 211. Law 5. Needs, urges, drives, and desires tend to arouse corresponding images, ideas, and emotions. Images and ideas, in turn, according to Law 1, prompt the corresponding action. One of the most widely occurring examples of this law is what is termed in psychoanalysis as rationalization. When a strong desire or urge exists, it influences the mind to find reasons, or rather pseudo-reasons, for its fulfillment. This process is also at the root of the general tendency to wishful thinking. Once we are aware of this law, we can be on the alert for the possibility of the mental and emotional illusions produced by rationalization. We can learn to become more aware of our drives, urges, and desires, and what they want us to do. Instead of being swept along with them or fooled into believing they are justified by valid reasons, we can examine these pseudo-reasons and decide for ourselves, from the central vantage point of our wills, whether or not we want to follow them. For example, if, as I am about to give a lecture to a large audience, I suddenly think of a very good reason to leave the stage and go home, I can remember this law and become aware of the compelling inner urge working on me. I might then choose to use one of the other psychological laws, imagining myself delivering a good lecture in a confident manner, thus calming my emotional agitation and also mobilizing myself to perform the willed action. If the will is used skillfully, there is no need to repress negative feelings or to override them harshly. Such procedures are inefficient and demand too high a price. Law 6. Attention, interest, affirmations, and repetitions reinforce the ideas, images, and psychological formations on which they are centered. Attention renders images and ideas clearer and more exact and enables new elements and details to be found. It may be compared to a lens through which we observe an object. The image is made larger, clearer, and sharper. That which is at the center of attention is well defined, whereas what is at its circumference remains dim. The latter can be termed marginal consciousness. It belongs to a semi-conscious sphere, an intermediate zone between the conscious and the unconscious. Interest increases the prominence of ideas and images. It makes them occupy a larger space in the field of our consciousness and remain in it for a longer span of time. It enhances and reinforces attention. Conversely, attention tends to increase interest. This is also a feedback process. Affirming images and ideas gives them stronger force and effectiveness. Repetition acts like the blows of a hammer on a nail and brings about the penetration and fixation of an idea or image until it becomes dominant and even obsessive. This is a technique much in use by advertisers. The huge sums they spend with profit in putting the same advertisement frequently before the eyes of the public are convincing proof of the effectiveness of repetition. There can also be an opposite utilization of this law. We can deliberately withdraw interest and attention from an unwanted image, idea, or psychological formation, and thus gradually de-energize it and reduce its activity. It will then cease to be a disturbing factor or a harmful influence. Several applications of this principle, in particular the technique of substitution, will be found in the next chapter in the section on psychological breathing and feeding. Law 6. Repetition of actions intensifies the urge to further reiteration and renders their execution easier and better until they come to be performed unconsciously. In this way, habits are formed. They can be compared to streets and roads. It is so much easier and more convenient to walk along a street than to force one's way through the undergrowth of uncultivated land. As repeated habitual actions are taken over by the conscious is freed for other and higher activities. This is an established fact in the case of biological functions. And Gustave Le Bon, in his book La psychologie, la éducation, goes so far as to state that education is the art
of making the conscious part into
the unconscious. While this is true of learning and skills, it is certainly not the aim of all education. One might say just the contrary in regard to its higher aspects. The etymology of education, educare, expresses its true purpose and function, to draw out the latent possibilities from the unconscious, to activate the energies dormant in it, particularly in its higher sphere, the superconscious. Habits tend to limit us and make us follow only beaten tracks. But as William James has aptly said, will and intellect can form habits of thought and will. We are responsible for forming our habits, and even when acting according to habits, we are acting freely. Law 8. All the various functions and their manifold combinations in complexes and subpersonalities adopt means of achieving their aims without our awareness, and independently of, and even against, our conscious will. This law has been called by Borden the law of subconscious finalism, and he has fully described its workings and explained the ways of utilizing it in therapy and education, in suggestion and auto-suggestion. It is a law of fundamental importance. We should realize that we are seldom conscious of the psychological and psychophysiological mechanisms which produce physical changes and outer actions. Here we have a real mystery of the relationship and interaction between psychological and physical facts, which, despite all attempts, has not yet been satisfactorily solved or explained. The simplest and clearest evidence is provided by a muscular movement. A man, let us say, wills to move, or has the idea of moving an arm. He does it easily, though he may be completely ignorant of the complex and admirably coordinated mechanism which converts the idea into the act. The idea, or mental picture of the arm movement, produces a stimulation of the motor cells in the cortex of the opposite hemisphere of the brain. From these motor cells, an impulse, which seems to be of an electrical nature, starts and flows through the fibres until it finally reaches the muscles involved in the movement. That stimulation produces the contraction of the muscle fibres, which activates the movement. A man with strong muscles can perform the movement as easily and more effectively than a learned anatomist or physiologist with a weak body. The same holds true not only for psychophysical reactions, but for all activities going on in the psyche itself. Complex and more extended processes also follow the same pattern. The mental picture of the aim to be attained starts an activity in the unconscious directed towards the accomplishment of the aim. But we remain ignorant of their operation. Creativity, whether artistic, scientific or technical, is a case in point. It often requires a period of elaboration or incubation, during which it is advisable to let the unconscious work without further interference from the conscious will. Paradoxically, paying conscious attention to, or being emotionally preoccupied with, creative processes disturbs them. What happens may be compared with an executive giving a worker a certain job to do. Once the worker has understood what has to be done, he should be allowed to do it without further interference or prodding. This shows the nature of spontaneity. From a certain point of view, the activity in the unconscious can be said to go on spontaneously. That is, spontaneously from our point of view, and without our conscious cooperation. Many creative artists and investigators have had practical experience of working with this law. Providing the initial impetus, they allow the further elaboration to occur naturally and spontaneously. But this is quite a different matter from the cult of spontaneity, as expressed in uncontrolled giving way to any emotion, impulse, or whim. Law 9. Urges, drives, desires, and emotions tend and demand to be expressed. Drives and desires constitute the active, dynamic aspect of our psychological life. They are the springs behind every human action. But their origin, nature, value and effects differ widely. These must therefore be recognized and then examined with the same objectivity with which one studies a natural object. The procedure necessitates disidentification from them, at least temporarily, and this in turn means acquiring awareness of the self, the conscious I, as distinct from these psychological elements and forces, and from that central point observing their flow. An act of will is called for here, and the will, as we have seen, is the most immediate and direct function of the I. Observation has to be followed by valuation. Science, particularly psychological science, cannot avoid valuation. A.H. Maslow has presented the reasons for this ably and convincingly in his books The Psychology of Science and Motivation and Personality. The practical problem, the issue that confronts us all the time, is this: how to give adequate and constructive, or at least harmless, expression to each of these urges, drives, emotions, etc. To give some expression to them is necessary. If we fail to do so, if fear, condemnation, or other motives induce us to deny or repress them, they produce psychological and nervous stress, and by affecting the body are apt to create psychosomatic disorders. This fact has been strongly emphasized by psychoanalysis, and on it based the present claim to eliminate all inhibitions and checks to the free course of the energies, lumped together under the general term libido. Yet this uncontrolled expression is often not desirable in the view of the harmful consequences it can have for oneself and other people, and in many cases it is not even possible. But there are a number of methods by means of which the impelling drives may be given harmless or constructive expression. Their value, multiplicity, and diversity demands that they be thoroughly known, carefully selected, and appropriately applied in accordance with the specific existential situations that continually confront us in life. The law which follows deals with these methods. Law 10. The psychological energies can find expression: 1. Directly, discharge, catharsis; 2. Indirectly, through symbolic action; and 3. Through a process of transmutation. 1. At first sight, the direct modes of expression do not appear to call for much comment. They are simply the means whereby the natural and healthy gratification of the fundamental needs and tendencies is obtained. But in reality, things are not that simple. Conflicts often develop between these needs and tendencies, conflicts placing priorities and limits on their gratification, or even negating its feasibility. Moreover, these tendencies cannot all be indulged at the same time. Their expression needs to be regulated on the basis of criteria of possibility and suitability, and this in turn necessitates deliberation, choices and decisions, in fact, acts of will. Certain restrictions inevitably impose themselves because of individual physical and psychological circumstances, obstacles created by our relations with other people, and social and environmental conditions in general. But these problems of control and regulation are not insoluble. When, and to the extent that direct expression must be delayed, modified, or even entirely disallowed, ways and means of indirect expression are at hand, which can offer adequate satisfaction and may be preferable. 2. A symbolic acting out is frequently just as satisfying and liberating as direct expression. For example, if anger provokes us to attack somebody we believe has treated us badly, its direct expression would involve us in a physical or verbal assault. But the same hostility can be discharged by trouncing some object that symbolizes our opponent. Another way of discharging hostility is to write a vituperative letter, giving full vent to one's bitterness and resentment, and then to not send it. The mere action of expressing anger and indignation on paper is often sufficient to discharge the energy or psychological voltage it carries. 3. Transformation and sublimation. These processes have a special importance in that their recognition and utilization offer the best and more lasting solution to many basic human problems. this warrants their thorough investigation and wide application. The breadth of the subject does not permit of its being adequately dealt with in the present context, but some of the essential points are presented here. The transformation of energies is a natural process going on at all levels, both horizontally within each level, physical, biological and psychological, and vertically between all the levels, where it can be seen as sublimation or degradation, according to whether the energy is carried to a higher or lower level. These transformations often occur spontaneously, but they can be induced by deliberate acts of work. At the physical level, heat may be converted into motion, the steam engine, or electricity, the thermoelectric generator. Electricity in its turn can be converted into heat, the electric stove, and motion, the motor. The knowledge and utilisation of these and many other transformations constitutes the basis of technology. Chemical combinations of substance produce other substances having different properties from those of their components, and in some cases bring about simultaneous release of heat and energy. In the physical sciences, there is a process called sublimation, through which a chemical substance passes from the solid state directly to a gaseous state, and, after cooling, to a final crystallization. It is interesting to note that sublimation of chemical elements is particularly valuable as a means of purification. At the biological level, countless transformations are constantly occurring or can be induced, all regulated in the wonderful ways that make life possible. At the psychological level too, transformations are happening all the time. Many of the phenomena governed by the above-mentioned laws are due to the interaction and transformation of the psychological energies. Most important, though their mechanism is still a mystery to us, are the transformations and interactions that take place vertically, that is, between the energies of the various levels. Of immediate interest are the biological and physical changes produced by the action of mental and psychological energies. Their study and utilization constitute a large field of psychosomatic medicine. There are then all the external actions determined by psychological factors. An idea combined with a desire or a feeling arouses an impulse to set in motion the corresponding physical activities. For instance, the desire for wealth in conjunction with a plan for acquiring it may prompt one to make a journey, embark upon some enterprise, construct a building. Love for a woman allied with an assessment of the conditions for marrying her has been known to transform itself into the urge to pursue certain studies or the determination to obtain a particular job. All the basic instincts and drives undergo such transformations, which are particularly evident in the case of self-assertion and aggressiveness, sexuality and love. The transformation of combative and aggressive drives has a central importance because it constitutes one of the most effective, perhaps the most effective, means of eliminating interpersonal conflicts and preventing war. As to sexuality and love, there is certainly no need to emphasize the fact that the ways to deal with these two powerful drives is an existential problem confronting every human being. The subject has been treated in Psychosynthesis, Chapter 8, and in my pamphlet, The Transformation and Sublimation of Sexual Energies. The ways and means of psychological transformation and sublimation can be summed up as A. Elevation, B. Purification, C. Interiorization, D. Extension, E. Outer Expression. A. By means of elevation, the merely physical sex drive can be transformed into emotional love, possessive love into oblative love, craving for sensuous pleasure into aspiration to experience ascetic, intellectual and spiritual joys. B. Purification is concerned principally with the nature of motives and intentions. C. Interiorization can transmute vanity and pride into a sense of inner dignity, personal self-assertion into spiritual affirmation, aggressive drives into a tool for dealing with inner enemies. This use has been aptly stated by Francis Wickens. One of our great tasks of our present day is to introvert war. D. Extension brings about the transformation of egotistic love in successive wider circles to love of family, of fellow workers, of one's country, of humanity. Paternal and maternal love, which may have been denied expression through lack of children, can be bestowed upon those of others, or upon all people who may need love and help. E. Outer expression corresponds to the crystallization of the sublimated chemical substances. Thus, compassion is expressed in humanitarian actions. Aggressive tendencies can be utilized in the struggle against social evils. It is important to realize, however, that there are pseudo-sublimitations which should be recognized and guarded against. They are a substitute, a counterfeit of the real thing. They can be a disguise covering over impulses and activities not really sublimated. In sublimation, it is sincere intention that counts. Pseudo-sublimation is present where there is hypocrisy, whether evident or not. The process of artistic creativity deserves special mention. It is considered a form of sublimation. It often is, but not always. In his creative activity, the writer, painter, or composer often gives expression to his drives, urges, and desires, as well as to his aspirations. For him, it is then a means of catharsis. On the nature and level of this expression depends the quality of the transformation of the energies involved. End of chapter 5 of Roberto Acidioli's The Act of Will, A Guide to Self-Actualization and Self-Realization.